Welcome to MacGuffin. I'm Alex, and with me, as usual, is James. You can check out our website, themacguffin.com, for all of our various previous podcasts. We most recently talked about The Killing, the Stanley Kubrick 1956 movie, I believe. Prior to that was A Fish Called Wanda. Before that was Rosemary's Baby, Lost City of Zed, and in one podcast we talked about Point Blank and The Limey. So yeah, you can check those out.
Welcome to the MacGuffin Men. And now, here are Alex and James.
James.
Yes. That was a good little mix of movies.
It was, yeah. Our mix has been... Once we just totally gave up on keeping up with modern cinema in any way, because modern cinema got way too boring to want to keep up with, it just becomes a lot easier to have a good mix of movies. You know, and I know The Lost City of Zed is a year old. It was released a year ago, but still. That's as close to a non-modern movie that you can have in modern times, you know?
That's true. And I know everyone's clamoring for our hot Infinity War takes, but...
Oh, yeah. Well, I suppose I have takes, but they're just angry. And more angry about the state of cinema than like, oh, the comic book heroes. Anyway, doesn't matter. Let's move on. Let's go back to the 40s when cinema was cinema.
Yeah. Let's go back to the Pisces when life was good.
Yeah. In the mid 1940s when everything was fine. Nothing bad was going on.
Yeah, we're talking about the Bicycle Thieves, which is a 1948.
Yes.
No. Yeah, and I mean a big part of it is it's kind of talked about as one of the beginnings of the Italian neorealism movement. But that is, you know, what we're kind of touching on there is that it's just very much informed by the time and place, and
yeah.
Like anything that really sets off a movement in a drastic shift in cinema or pretty much any art form. It's as a result of some pretty big societal changes, right?
Yeah, and just to politely correct you a little bit, like I think Bicycle Thieves is the Italian neorealist film that is remembered as being an Italian neorealist film. You know, it's very it encapsulates everything that movement tried to encapsulate in their films, but it's not really the first one, you know. It's one that sort of was able to capture everything that had been done up to that point, and it just sort of eventually over time became the most famous Italian neorealist film and just becomes the to use a horribly overused phrase, like the Mount Rushmore of Italian neorealism, you know. But it's all four heads, this one, you know.
Yeah, well, so yeah, so it's not the Washington, it's like a Lincoln. It's one of the best summations of what you can do,
there you go,
with this genre, because yeah, there's Rome Open City, and as I said, this is 48, and I think that people really mark the beginnings of it at 43. Mm-hmm. And as you said, this really kind of brings it all together. No one really recognized quite the shift that was happening, but this one really, you can look back on and see a lot of the touchstone characteristics of this subgenre.
Yeah, exactly. And even to go further back, like just doing a little bit of research, the first Italian movie that was shot all in on location, as in not on studio grounds, was this movie called What Scoundrels Men Are! !
Yes,
that was released in 1932, that Vittorio De Sica is actually in as an actor, and then went on to direct Bicycle Thieves and co-write it. So yeah, it's I don't know, it just I mean, in our first year film class at university, when we did a week on Italian neorealism, this was the movie we watched, was Bicycle Thieves, you know? So that's sort of it's in Film 101 syllabuses as the Italian neorealism film, you know? Yeah, so in this movie is directed and co-written by Vittorio De Sica. I don't know that we mentioned his name before my passing mention of him there. And yeah, he's just, in my head, always been sort of a part of these... these like fathers or these important Italian filmmakers. But also he's so attached to the movement, or I keep saying movement. Yeah, I hate when people use the word movement, but just this type of film, I guess, is what I mean to say. The Italian neorealist film, where other filmmakers like Fellini's La Strada is considered kind of a part of this this type of film. But also Fellini became such a figure in his own right that he's not really like tied to a type of film like Italian neorealism, or Antonioni, his blow up is considered sort of a cousin of it, an eventual cousin, because that movie came out in like 1964 or something. But again, Italian directors who became more famous on their own than any sort of type of like specific type of movie, whereas De Sica, in my eyes, in the way that my knowledge of cinema history has always sort of tied them together, is just tied to this type of film, kind of in the same way Jean-Luc Godard is tied to the French New Wave to me, you know. And Godard as a director is clearly more famous, I think, to the average person than De Sica is, because French New Wave is just more well known than Italian neorealism. But I think it's not a horrible comparison, you know?
No, that makes
sense. And also, in my eyes, like Breathless is one of the like capital French New Wave films, you know, capital F French New Wave films.
Yeah. Hmm. I mean, I guess we can start with what Italian neorealism is. And just because you mentioned, we talked about having done a podcast about The Killing, and we talked about how even that, what year did you say that was? 56, 58?
My guess is 56.
Yeah. We talked about how that kind of managed to get away from some of the more stilted dialogue, and that was one of the things that I praised about it. And, but man, when you compare this to that, this just, I mean, the name neorealism or realism says it all, but I was really taken aback by how natural so much of this seemed.
Yeah.
Like it's, obviously there are things that are different than if you were trying to have a very naturalistic feeling movie now, but I was, just because of the decade that it's in, I'm just so used to the carryover from theater acting and, you know, early cinema, and just being so emotive and so grand in your expressions and delivery of dialogue, that I kind of never got over how much like real life the conversations in this movie are.
Yeah, exactly. And also, like, kind of in real life, this is a situation, like what Antonio goes through throughout this movie is the type of situation that wouldn't lead to having a lot of long involved conversations. You know, every conversation in this movie is very, very short because he's just constantly moving. Even when he's got his job, like part of his job is sort of constant movement or semi-constant movement, you know? And as such, there's partially not time to have those conversations where you start to feel how, you know, how not realistic they are when exposition starts to make its way in. Like, there's not much exposition to be had in this movie because it's so easy to grasp, you know, which I think is another
No, it's not much more than the title to
exactly
say everything that happens in this movie.
No, exactly. And I think that is also part of how it sort of became the movie that was most remembered from this time period. I mean, again, not a scholar of Italian neorealism in any way. But I can see the things in Bicycle Thieves that remind me of regular movies tied into the things in Bicycle Thieves that remind me of how I understand Italian neorealism to be, sort of create this kind of, this middle ground that I can easily see why, it was relatively quickly accepted by American audiences, and also was just able to be remembered. But yeah, and I think what you're saying about dialogue and the way characters speak and that being very realistic, I think that can't be removed from the things that I would notice about it that make it feel surprisingly modern and realistic by the standards of 1948 filmmaking. And that's the primarily they're not on sets, with the exception of that one scene where they're in the car truck, I guess, and it's raining. The guy's talking about he doesn't go to the movies, it bores him. That's pretty obviously on a set. But pretty much everything else, it seems to be on location, which in 1948, again, is just very uncommon. This is another, that's another thing we would have meant, I probably mentioned in the Killing podcast, you know, how we're still used to movies at this time looking like the Maltese Falcon, where there's clearly a wall that has been built by a human within the last couple weeks, and Humphrey Bogart is standing in front of it, and just behind that wall is just like, I don't know, a dude at craft services, you know?
Yeah, he's on his mark and he can't step 2 feet backward.
Exactly, because he'd knock over the wall, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. And I just think that, like, it just sort of, that surrounds the dialogue that you're saying. I think you can kind of feel its effect without necessarily even noticing it, you know? Just because, also, like, this movie... I don't know if you were watching the Criterion version of this movie, but the remaster of this movie is like all time perfect. And so I was like taken aback by how beautiful it looked. And also I recognize that part of that is just that this movie, like very few movies from the 1940s, has gotten just the absolute most luxurious treatment over the years. You know, it has been restored in the most impeccable possible way, you know. And that's another way that it is able to feel more modern than 1948, just because it has been physically taken care of better than most movies from 1948.
Yeah. Yeah. And it was quickly recognized as something special. And that has been, as you said, just kind of carried over. So it's been taken care of well. And yeah, it was the Criterion one that I watched. And as something, you know, as a piece of not just neorealism, but Italian neorealism, to have it so closely tied to a specific nationality, it's great to see it just shot on location like that. Like, it just seems like such a celebration of that time, and that time and that place specifically. So to talk about it as cinema of a specific country, you know, we haven't really touched on exactly what Italy was going through at the time that Italian neorealism was taking off, as we said, like 43, and then this is 48. Mm-hmm. But I mean, I think it's well known that that was a very tough time in Italy, just post-World War II. And
Mussolini dies in 1945, like right in the middle of those two dates you said, yeah.
Yeah, and they haven't had an election, a proper democratic election in something like 20 years by the time this one comes out. And, you know, just World War II did not treat them very well, obviously, mm-hmm. and the economic collapse that came after this. Just to have it tied in with the nationality, and as I said, to shoot it on location to really celebrate these locations and to not use a lot of extras, you know, to just go out and shoot on a location, mm-hmm. whoever happened to be there, and dress up and block traffic, and to use non-actors. It's not a super positive time in Italy's history, but to have it captured in this way, I think, is really meaningful.
Yeah, absolutely. And something that I was reading about is that part of what forced people to use location is that the main studio for filmmaking in Italy was damaged in the war. And so it just sort of parts of it, or it just became either harder to access or just unusable for certain things. And just even from that, just that fact, I think it was called like CineFit or something. I obviously am pronouncing it horribly, but CineFitte, I believe is how it was spelled. And yeah, it's just like, in the 1960s or whatever, if Pinewood in England had been highly damaged, like, where does Stanley Kubrick go to make 2001, you know? Does that change the movie? You know, and just sort of the way that the war in the case of Bicycle Thieves and Italian neorealism affected movies, in that it sort of push them onto location because certain studios were no longer an option, at least temporarily.
Yeah, yeah,
like that,
yeah.
That sort of ties it right in with history, just in a way that you would never know without reading about it. But it does, you know, it does tie it into history.
Yeah, and to contextualize it a bit further, again, from my understanding, is that the 30s in America, in Italian cinema, was really Americanized. Like the Americans and Hollywood was obviously huge internationally, and so it seemed like, from my understanding, that Italian cinema was for the most part doing a lot to copy, mm-hmm. you know, American cinema, and it was pretty, you know, down the middle of what we expect from American cinema at that time, just promoting social values. And it was just Italian cinema was known for these soft comedies that just enforced class structure and, you know, respect for authority and everything we know and love about films before, like during the Hays Code and things like that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, emphasizing country life and everything that's great about that. And then World War II comes along and things get very real and very depressing, and it's no longer about using cinema as an escape, and it's about showing a bit more of a realistic representation of Italian life, and particularly about urban Italian life and the hardships that were being suffered by so many people in Italy at that time. And as I said, to use people instead of actors, and to use these real set these real locations instead of sets. It's just this idea of the real world kind of becoming undeniable, and that to keep making these sort of comedy of errors and these social comedies with no real consequences just would have been so out of touch with what the people viewing these movies were experiencing, who had gone through such tragedy so recently. And this is on the nose. And I want to know what you thought about just this idea of our main character not having much individualism. Like, does he strike you as just a stand-in for so many people? Or do you think that there was a particular character that they were getting at? And if you thought that was a positive or a negative towards the movie as a whole? Because you've gone long enough without really talking about what's inside this movie.
No, that is true. But I think more than a lot of the movies we talk about, it is really helpful to sort of set the stage for what influenced this movie and this type of filmmaking in general. But yeah, just
and this probably more than most.
Yeah, exactly. And going back to what you were saying about the way Italian films were in the 1930s, and it was just very standard and Americanized and cover up all of our problems sort of thing. A member of government at the time, his name was Giulio Andreotti, a name I, again, might be mispronouncing horribly.
Blanket apologies on all the Italian.
Yeah, yeah. Blanket, despite the fact that I am partially Italian, I cannot pronounce these Italian names. That's how Italian they are. But he described neorealism as quote-unquote dirty laundry that shouldn't be washed and hung to dry in the open. Like, it's sort of... This is a member of government saying that, like... This isn't filmmaking. This is closer to what life actually is, and we don't really want people to see that, you know. And
not inaccurate. It just isn't for
exactly. It just yeah. Like we would feel better if this isn't how this isn't the version of Italy that people saw right now or potentially ever. But yeah. So what you were saying about Antonio, our lead in the movie. I don't know. I mean, especially like his introduction and the last shot of the movie really sort of, I suppose especially the last shot of the movie really puts him as sort of just a person in the crowd. And the beginning, he is kind of individualized from the beginning because he's so confident that there will be no work for him that he doesn't even join the crowd when the guy that shows up to announce the jobs for the day shows up, you know, at the very, very beginning of the movie, the guy's calling out Ricci, which is Antonio's last name. And somebody has to run and get him because he didn't even stand up to go and see if there was work for him. So he's kind of individualized in that way, where if you want to look at that as a way outside of just introducing our character and making sure that people understand that this is the guy we're going to be following, which in this not very complicated film isn't a necessity in the way it can be in some movies, you can sort of see him as somebody who is either weak and willing to give up, as opposed to all the other people that are still standing waiting for these jobs, or somebody that is just like an every person who nobody could keep standing after taking all these beatings. Like, it's just, that's how bad it is in Italy right now. And for the working class, it's just so hard that even when jobs come to be announced, there's no point in getting up because you just assume there will be nothing, you know? I don't think the movie takes a stance on Antonio in either way. I think there are certain handful of moments in this movie where he acts in a way that makes him unlikable. Even if he didn't hit his kid, there are still moments when he's just being kind of a shitty person, even just following the old man through the church and disrupting that service. But they all tend to be things that I can empathize with given the situation, you know? So, I mean, I can't say that like Antonio is the most likable character in the world, but I also realize he's in a situation I can't even sort of like, you know, I've never had real money problems in my life, you know? So I just try to empathize with it. Yeah, I don't know. I'm curious. Do you have any sort of take on Antonio as a character?
No, I kind of do see him as that everyman. I saw, just reading a lot of reviews, that they say really the only sense of, or the only chance it gets at individuation is when he decides to go buy some pizza, or like, you know, he and his son go in and just enjoy the restaurant. And it really is the only time you see him smile. And I think that, you know, he just takes his foot off the gas a little bit, and he's, you know, you can forgive him for doing so, because the rest of this movie is almost literally him just running around and trying to solve this problem that might have his family go starving and evicted, right? Mm-hmm. That there's just no chance for him to express his individuality, because he is so determined to fix his lot and the lot of his family, which I don't feel that is a big negative to the film. I just think that reinforces the dire straits that he's kind of found himself in.
Yeah, I see that. But I mean, I assume you sort of you definitely sort of in the last shot see him as just joining the crowd again, for sure, I would imagine.
Yeah, I mean, it is literally what happens, and I think that's...
And he sort of disappears, too, you know? Like, it feels like he disappears, you know? Like, as he walks in with that group of people.
Yeah, I don't know, because in thinking that this guy is not really an actor, and his kid, same thing, you know, picked out of the crowd, just it taken for this role.
So Enzo, I forget his last name, just because it's an interesting story. Enzo Staiola just happened to be watching the filming of a scene with Antonio. He was just somebody shooting in his city. He's like, oh, I'm gonna take a look at this, presumably with a parent. De Sica just saw him watching and saw his face, you know, which is a... every time I've watched this movie with somebody, which is like three different times, the person I've watched it with comments on specifically on that kid's face and how he looks like a 38-year-old, 8-year-old, you know, like it's, I don't know. He just has such a unique look, and that's what De Sica spotted. And he's just like, do you want to be in this movie? Yes. Okay, cool. And also, Antonio, he didn't come out to audition for the role. He brought his kid to audition for Bruno. And again, De Sica was like, no, you are the person who will be playing Antonio. You know, your kid can go home, but you can stay. You know?
I saw that for the child who plays Bruno, that part of it was his walk. And I only saw that after the fact. I saw this movie again in university, but forgot almost everything about it. To the point that the fake out bicycle theft of when he goes upstairs to see the seer and comes back and his bike's still there, that absolutely got me this time through. But yeah, they said that one of the reasons they hired that child was because of his walk, and just watching him walk around their apartment before the bike's even stolen, he has some swagger to him that is just incredible. And that is kind of one of the things that I just can't find in the script or the filmmaking about either this father or son, that I get what people say that there might not be an individual there, but there is something about their performances and their look. I mean, he's just a good looking guy. You know what I mean?
And so also for the everyman thing, I've watched this movie a couple times this past week, and just both times I've been like, man, that guy looks like somebody, and I have not been able to figure out who. And I think that really speaks to the sort of everyman quality that he has. And like, a really good looking everyman sort of thing, but
a regular handsome, but handsome.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, and I mean, what you're describing is so much of what acting is making, like, most great performances have to have an element that isn't on the page, you know, because you can't entirely write a great characterization for film. You know, the actor can still screw it up or make it infinitely better. And I think that is what you're describing, is that De Sica just nailed the casting, which is you know, something we've said off and on throughout this podcast, is that just casting well almost matters more than a collection of performances in your movie. You know, you just, if you pick the right person and that person is watchable on screen in a way that combines with what you need them to portray in your movie, they can cover up things that aren't in the script or make you feel like things that aren't in the script are there, you know.
Yeah, and that tightrope walk, and it's interesting thinking De Sica did a lot of comedies as well, because I think there are moments in this that a different actor or a different filmmaker or some tweak one degree or the other, this kind of slips into comedy. And the part that you had mentioned about him chasing the old man through the church, like, I think that this is an inch away from that being silly or kind of losing me. And even the way that the two priests genuflect, like they do the sign of the cross on their way out, him chasing someone through a church, that could be a funny scene, you know, but it does just have this urgency, and it has a silly quality to it, but it never comes off as goofy or making light of the situation. And I think that to be so close to something that, like, you know, that sounds like a set piece in a comedy.
Yeah, and
it doesn't quite get there, because I think it's handled in a way that you see this juxtaposition. You see that this is not the way that you're supposed to act in this setting, and that should be that comedy of errors that I could imagine was all over those 1930s Italian films that didn't really resonate and that we don't know the names of anymore because they don't, you know, they don't matter in the grand scope of cinema.
Yeah.
Sorry to everyone making Italian movies in the 1930s.
don't worry, that. they're all dead now.
That's right. But I think that it's right on that brink, but this manages to avoid those pitfalls. And the way that movies from 70 years ago can so easily be like, oh, I can see how I was supposed to care about this, but now it looks so goofy. This, even after all these decades and almost a century passes, manages to avoid that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, what you're saying about that being a potential comedy set piece, Bruno gets full on like Three Stooges bopped in the head in that scene, you know, when he pulls the curtain back and a priest or somebody's just sitting behind the curtain and just bops him on the head. You know, you just hear the sound effect that would have played in a louder comedy there. So yeah, I understand entirely what you're saying. And so much of a film aging gracefully is just somehow cutting out the things of the time period that won't work 40 to 50 years later. And, you know, this is just a movie that does that. It's just very bare bones. It feel the fact that the conflict of the movie is so so universal. It's just somebody who wants his family to have a good life and just is trying to provide that, and is given something in the case of the job that can, you know, can make his life better. And then just the pain of having that getting taken away in such a like small way, that ends up like just having a bicycle stolen that just has so much weight, you know. And there's that scene in the when they're walking through the bicycle market and he's just looking at example after example of something that he needs, but just and is physically inches away from, and he just can't have it. He just has no way to attain it. And
there's hundreds of them and anyone would do, but
exactly.
He can't.
No, exactly. And I just think like that's the type of pain that is just universal. And the movie never, it just, it's like it makes every decision correctly in a way that sort of ensures its timelessness, you know? That's impressive in a way that, like, you know, nobody's on set thinking, oh, in 2018, I don't know if this will play, you know? Like, De Sica's not standing around in 1948 or 1947, whenever they shot this movie, talking about how the movie's going to age, you know? But it's just important to instinctually be able to nail those to be able to create a film that not only is popular at the time, but ends up becoming something that's in film textbooks, you know?
Yeah. So. Yeah. Film 101 textbooks.
Yeah.
Yeah. And like similar, just talking about these very universal themes. His wife sells, you know, her sheets, which are very important to her. I mean, they're her dowry sheets. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of a concept that where we live is not something that really exists any longer. But we get introduced to this idea of him needing money and her sacrificing something very dear to her. And we spend some time in their domestic space and we see Bruno and we see their even younger child. And yeah, even if you've never had a dowry or never pawned something to, you know, get your husband a chance at making a living, that's just our exposure to their, you know, their proximity, their nearness, their, you know, we're in this domestic space, we see the sacrifice she makes for him, the sacrifice, you know, many wives make for their husbands, many husbands make for their wives, any permutation of that, just this closeness and their willingness to kind of put everything on the line for each other. And as you said, that even after all this time, the words change and the specific objects or the specific nature of them change, but we spend this time in their home, in their domestic space that they share before the rest of this movie takes place outside. And so we kind of get introduced to them on this very personal level quickly. And she's not in this movie a lot, but there is this gesture by her. I mean, more than a gesture, this action by her that shows her willingness and her belief in him, and that they truly are this team that is doing something together. And I think one of the really touching moments is when, I mean, not touching in a positive way, but when he goes and pawn, or they go and pawn the sheets and they give them whatever value they deem. And, you know, there's a bit of discussion about the price, but there's no other place to go. You know, you kind of just take what they're going to give you. And just the abundance of those sheets, you know, it gets lost in this massive pile. He climbs up row after row, and it means so much to these two people, specifically to her. And it's just, you know, just another number and just another nameless sheet that just kind of gets stocked away. And that there are these, you know, coming out of World War II, we have just this level of industrialization and this gigantic, I mean, not to the globalization we know now, but the way that the economy and the world was globalized and kind of shrunk down by industry and communication, for you to feel like something so lost in the shuffle like that is summed up really quickly, just in that shot. And there's no dialogue while he puts it away, and there's no discussion about, you know, how small they feel watching something like that happen. But it's just communicated visually, I think, in a very successful way.
Yeah, absolutely. And Maybe you pointed this out, but and I just missed it. But also in that moment, that happens after Antonio has gone to give that money for the bike, and when the guy leaves to go get his bike, that's when you see the person with the sheets cross in front of frame. So it's like you don't even necessarily realize these two places are physically linked. You know that the windows that they're speaking into are very similar, so, and that they're in the same building, but you don't know how close they are to each other. And then you just see Antonio smiling as his bike is getting fetched for him. And then you just see what it took to get that bike just cross right in front of his eye line.
And
that leads to the shot that you were describing, which is, I mean, the best, visually the most, like the coolest shot in the movie, you know. It's the most intense stunt work in the movie, at least.
When the thief rides the bike down that hill through all the traffic, that's pretty cool too.
Yeah, fair enough. And Bruno almost accidentally actually being hit by a car two times in one shot later on. That just, you know, this is what we had to give up to get this, you know. And this is just, I just think the way that they pair those two images is really, it's really good.
Yeah, and speaking about, as I was earlier, the way that the Italian cinema in the 30s, so much of it was just set in the country, and, you know, you have this feeling of ownership and individuality more out in the country, that this move to the urban centers that happened in Italy and a lot of places around that time, with industrialization, he knows exactly which bike is his in this row of bikes when he's getting it back after he's paid off the fee. And this guy is just some guy working behind a counter, and there's 1,000 bikes, like your bike's just one in the pile. And just the way that can transfer over to someone living in an urban center like that to get lost in the shuffle so easily.
Yeah, absolutely.
Any other visual ones that stand out to you?
Not really. I think it's pretty, I think something that I found very impressive and about this movie in general is, given the time period and the fact that they're kind of experimenting with filmmaking in a way that was still new in shooting on location, or relatively new, I find it to be a very, very impressively shot film just in general, even though the camera work and shot composition is relatively simple. I just find it impressive. And again, like I can't stress the imperceptible importance that a very good transfer of a movie from the 1940s can that effect that it can have on you. So I realize that plays into something. But, you know, you can see the limitations of what they can do. It seems like they have some, like, they have, like, 1 8-foot dolly track, and that's all they've got for camera movement. Because all of the camera movements in this movie are really nice and beautiful, but very limited. It's, like, you get a lot of push-ins, and, like, by the end of the movie, when I'd see the push-in start, I'd be like, oh, this will stop here. And I was right every time. And that's not like me being some genius in any way. That's just me understanding, like, it really felt like they had this one piece of equipment, and they just used it in the same way a lot of times, which is very common on a film set in general. But since it was just such a simple movement, like, it was just easy for me to sort of decipher. But that's also something I found interesting about this movie is that apparently a lot of times they were rolling on a bunch of different cameras simultaneously, which I never would have guessed. And I feel like the movie feels so composed in most scenes and most important shots that it never gives off that impression, which I think is something that, in the best case scenario, a movie that shoots with multiple cameras is always trying to hide that it's shooting with multiple cameras. And the fact that I had seen this movie like 5 times before I knew that is, I think it's just really impressive, you know?
Yeah. There's the one that stands out to me, which is again, not a complicated shot, but when they go over, it's the kind of the rear tire of a bunch of these bikes. And it's just this dolly shot that's going from right to left. You probably know the one. It's that same like 8-foot track.
Where are they physically in the movie?
That's the one. It's just right before they get the cop to check the serial number.
Okay. Yep. Yeah, I can picture that.
Yeah, and that was kind of one of the ones that stood out to me as a shot that they'd want to get. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Obviously, they want to get them all the way that they did, but with the sets of cameras, like as you said, multiple sets of cameras or multiple cameras. That one just struck me as those don't often stand out to me, and that was just one nice one again to show just all these bikes and how that he's looking for one and there's so many and they're right there, but he just can't, you know, find the needle in the haystack.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I was reading some people comparing this to Citizen Kane, another very influential film, and saying that Citizen Kane has more of a sense of egoism to it. You know, we have this Orson Welles film and Orson Welles is a part of it. And, you know, we see a lot of the things that we have, a lot of the things that people talk about giving a ton of credit for with Citizen Kane, kind of these new kinds of shots that people weren't doing before and showing parts of the set or, you know, showing a ceiling or a ceiling fan in a way that is, you know, flashy. I know that description didn't make it sound very flashy, but to do something that is still pretty noticeable, and that this movie kind of lacks that ego. It's not starring a movie star. It's not these big sets. It's literally shot on location with natural light. And again, the lighting in Citizen Kane is something people talk about a lot. These kind of highly constructed, well-composed shots that are absent in this movie. And I didn't know what you thought of that description, if this movie truly does kind of lack that ego. And that kind of ties into my question about Antonio being a bit of an everyman and not so much of an individual. If this is that much of a blue-collar film, as much as it tries to show a blue-collar man solving a blue-collar problem, I didn't know if anything stood out to you as against the grain of that description.
No, I think your description is apt, especially of the ego of the filmmaking of Citizen Kane. I mean, Orson Welles was a big personality, famously, you know, and
as time passed, we learned more and more about that part of him as well, right?
Exactly. And so yeah, you're exactly right, and this is just Bicycle Thieves is a much more laid back movie stylistically, but I think it's a really well made movie that feels realistic and is I don't want to say hides, but or covers up. I don't know. I can't think of the right way to say it, but it's a really well put together movie. It's not like a you know, like a Duplass Brothers movie or a Joe Swanberg movie or something where everything's just handheld, also because a lot of handheld camera work at the time was pretty untenable in the 1940s for technological reasons. But it still feels like a movie made by professionals. It just doesn't feel like a movie made by all caps, exclamation point, professionals like Citizen Kane does, you know, people that want you to see how professional they are. There's a lot of really nice composition in the movie. Like doorways are used for framing really well, especially in the first 15 to 20 minutes when we're closer to Antonio's home, and the way that him and Maria, his wife, are separately framed in those windows when they're as Maria's trading in the sheets or as Antonio's getting the bicycle, their faces are framed in really pretty classical ways, but just they look very beautiful. They're beautiful shots. Antonio standing by the doorway of the fortune teller's place with the bike, that first fake out that you think is going to lead to a bicycle theft. There's lots of really nice composition and professionalism in a way that doesn't make it feel slapdash or run and gun or anything like that, in a way that we so we tend to link realism with sort of like handheld camera work, you know, at this point in filmmaking. But it feels like Bicycle Thieves feels like a realistic film that just happens to know which of the techniques from that time period that they shouldn't use or maybe couldn't use, given the restraints of their budget or the fact that they were shooting on location. And it just sort of makes this movie in a very professional way that it never screams at you in a way that like a Fellini movie would, like 8.5 does, where it's just like, this is style, you know, or Citizen Kane is
jump cuts or something.
Yeah, right? Exactly. It's just, yeah, it's just a really well-made movie by total pros, you know, that understand that not being overly stylish helps this movie.
Yeah, and that is that, like, that lines up so well with a blue-collar everyman aesthetic, right? It's, I go to work and I work hard, but I don't, you know, I don't put this Rita Hayworth poster, like, mm-hmm. super high up on a flagpole. You know, it's exactly what you want me to do as a professional.
Yeah, I work hard and it has some sort of effect on the world, but not everybody can spot it immediately. Excuse me, totally just burped on the podcast. My apologies. but yeah,
he's not putting those posters up in an auteur style, right?
No, exactly. He's just doing it like a lot of other people would, you know, and it affects the world around him, but not in a way that just screams, look at me, you know, whereas Citizen Kane, pretty much every frame screams, look at me. It's also, Citizen Kane is also a movie about a man with a giant ego, in the same way Bicycle Thieves is about a normal person. So they really tie in well in that way. That comparison is very apt.
Yeah. And I think, one thing that strikes me is that I think that a lot of movies like this will come back to something like religion or, you know, these group settings that even in these hard times, that there's always going to be this to fall back on. And I think that this avoids that in an interesting way. I don't think it besmirches, you know, pro-social values or has something bad to say about religion. But
no. Yeah.
I think it's interesting the way he's rushed out of these places, or that he never finds this comfort zone, and he tries all these different settings and never really fits in. And again, he's looking for something, so it makes sense that he's on the move. But just the way that there is this lack of comfort and that there's always this drive, I found really interesting. And that really, we aren't meant to empathize with the bicycle thief, you know, the man who I think fakes a seizure or yeah. something. But there's all these different, you know, there's these communist meetings, there's this musical theater rehearsal, there's the church, there's the fortune teller, there's all these places that fail to give him what he wants, and he's just in this dire situation. And I think one of the most meaningful parts of this movie is when he kind of turns into everything that has caused him this problem, right? Like, he ends up stealing a bicycle, mm-hmm. and something that we kind of get to know this thief a little bit, but we imagine he's stealing this bicycle for the same reason Antonio wants a bicycle, you know, for a bit of money for him and his family. He's not this crime kingpin that's just stealing all these bikes and, you know, living the high life off the profits that he's ill-gotten. But there is this sense of desperation that just kind of turns everybody on to each other, and that there's this this crab in a bucket mentality, more so than this, if we all bind together, everything's going to be okay. And it's just not a super positive message. And I don't think that this is saying anything bad about groups or about religion or about Italy or about anybody, but just the desperation of being put in a situation like those people and many other groups have been put in. And I think that that's something that still feels very modern and immediate to me watching it today.
Yeah, and I think especially you brought up the fact that the bicycle thief, or the first bicycle thief, we get a bit of story about him as well. And like you were saying, everything about it just reminds us of Antonio. He's somebody that, you know, that isn't building an empire on stolen bikes. He's somebody that he needs that money. And so in a way that Antonio eventually decides he needs that bike when he tries to steal a bike, you know, it's just like, this is a human being and things are so bad for him that he's got to steal from another human being.
In the way that his neighborhood comes to his defense, it's, yeah. it's frustrating for us because we come to align ourselves with Antonio, but it's also this group of people who's standing by their neighbor, which doesn't seem like such a negative attribute for a group to have.
Yeah, exactly. And also you could see that guy getting arrested. You can't see Antonio necessarily getting his job back. You know, it might be, if he decides to press charges, say that group of people isn't there, he decides to press charges, that, you know, that bike's probably already sold. Who knows if it's been resold or whatever, whether or not they can track it down. He might just be like negatively affecting somebody's life in a way that doesn't even end up helping him in the long run. So even in the absence of a group, you can kind of see why Antonio would choose not to press charges just after seeing that, yeah, this is a person dealing with the same things that I'm dealing with. And that pretty soon after that is when Antonio tries to steal a bike of his own, is when he really sees what sort of predicament that other person, the first bicycle thief, could have been in. And he sees like that desperation, steals the bike, and then the person who he stole the bike from ends up seeing that desperation in Antonio, and it's like, okay, let him go, you know. And I think that's the key for that sort of everyman vibe of this movie, that every person has their story, and you can assume that this person's a villain, but they have their reasons for something as well. And I mean, maybe they are a villain, but also maybe they're not. Maybe they're somebody that just doesn't have money and needs whatever amount of money a bike can get for them. One thing I did want to point out is I really like the way that you mentioned Church, but I was more interested in the fortune teller in this movie, because I think the way that they sort of depict how Antonio's family visits that fortune teller, I think that's a really interesting thing in this movie. And it's sort of used in a way that I think reminded me of, it's sort of, I think it pairs very well with Church in general, because I think when Antonio's actually at a church, he's at such a time where we can't really get his feelings on a church or religion in general, because he's just, it doesn't matter where that guy walked into, he was following that guy. And the only thing he cares about is following that guy. He doesn't care about respecting the church in any way, or whatever location that he had could have hypothetically walked into. But at the fortune teller, both times he sort of goes with agency in some capacity. One, he's just the first time he goes because he want his wife Maria wants to go. And, you know, they're just having a casual stroll with his bike and things are going well for them for a very brief period of time. And then he walks in and he's like, why are we doing this? I'm done with waiting around. And Maria says, I owe her 50 lira. She said things were going to turn for us. And here we are. You have your bike, you have a job. And then he pulls her out of there. And then at the end of the movie, he's so desperate that he turns to the fortune teller again. And, he doesn't see the point of the fortune teller when everything's going well, but when all is lost, he's willing to go to something more mystical, just because like anything within the physical realm just doesn't, like he doesn't see any possibilities in front of him anymore. So he needs to go to somebody that sees something that's not physical, you know, something that may or may not exist. And I think you could put any member of the church in the place of that fortune teller and the scene would be basically exactly the same, you know?
Yeah.
And I just think that's a really interesting depiction of religion and mysticism in any way, is that I think a lot of people, you know, people like me, again, have had the easiest life possible in pretty much every respect, don't see the point of religion or anything mystical. But when pushed to, like when things are going well, you don't see the point. But if you're in a moment of desperation and you just don't see any hope, you can kind of see the appeal of something outside of the physical realm. And I think this movie does a really good job of not necessarily talking about religion or mysticism as much as what would lead somebody to consider it an option, you know?
Yeah, and then to zoom out on that, it's this time period. I mean, we call it Italian neorealism, and then my understanding is that in you know, in Italian cinema, they just call this the Golden Age.
Yeah.
Like, there's no, it doesn't need to be qualified in those ways as Italian, obviously. And then neorealism just implied that this was a time that they got it right. And as we said, this came out of something so bad. Like, yeah. it was an economic collapse after World War II for Italy. The lira is so devalued and so many people had died, and the government was just in this state of flux, and no one really knew what was going to happen in this country. So we go from the 30s, where everything is, or for the most part, the dominant culture seems to be this really soft, Americanized form of cinema that has nothing to say. And then in the 50s, Italy goes through its what's called their, like, the Italian miracle economic period. They just had a huge boon and things were going very well for them for a long time. And it's just interesting to me that this is the time period that, while they were suffering so much, cinema found something to say, and a very compelling way to say it. And this really low period between, you know, some cultural highs was a time that they managed to use this art form to say something so interesting and so distinct. And Bicycle Thieves, as we said, sums that up so well.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, if you look at, you know, what continued to influence, or the way this movie influenced the style of film, the Italian neorealist style of film, influence film going forward. Italian neorealism was a big influence on the French New Wave, which in turn was a huge, you know, probably the primary influence on the second golden age of American cinema and the American Revolution in the 70s. That this movie, Bicycle Thieves, really speaks to the type of cinema it is. It's cool, it's interesting that it comes out of a time of such strife, and it's interesting in the way that it continues to at least for a time period, directly influenced or tangentially influenced so many movies that are also talked about in these textbooks that we have we've brought up, you know, and or I suppose these hypothetical textbooks that we have mentioned in passing. And I just think that's we've talked almost as much, if not more, about history on this episode than we have about the actual movie. Part of that is that for a movie as good as it is, it's pretty easy to talk about in a span of about 20 minutes. And the really interesting thing is how it's a piece of history at this point, as much as it is a film. And I think that really speaks to, I think it's an accomplishment, and I think it's an accomplishment for the genre. And I mean, that's why we're talking about it in 2018, you know? Vittorio De Sica and company. Nice job.
So yeah, hot take. Bicycle Thieves is a good movie.
Yeah, exactly. So thanks for listening to the MacGuffin Man, and be sure to check back next week.